Hey everyone, it's Nate here from The Vinyl Guide. This is the first episode of 2020, and right now Australia is burning. We need your help, and you can provide that help at patreon.com/vinylguide, where we are donating 100% of all patron fees to the fire efforts. If you check the news, there are major fires all over the country that are out of control. They've already burned some 12 million acres, or roughly the size of Vermont and New Hampshire combined. As of today, there's over 20 people dead, hundreds of homes lost, an estimated 500 million animals dead, including approximately 1/3 of the world's koala population, gone. And there's no end in sight. Join our Patreon community at patreon.com/vinylguide. We have exclusive interviews and contents for the Patreon community, secret episodes, and more. Plus, every cent you sponsor goes to the firefighters and the victims of the Australian bushfires. Be generous if you can. $20, $50, whatever you can is great. We are safe. We are lucky. We're able to enjoy our holidays in front of the record player. So many others cannot and are literally running for their lives. Help us help them any way you can, including at patreon.com/vinylguide. Thanks in advance for your support. And now, on with the show.
Hey, this is Dr. D. Bento, and you're listening to The Vinyl Guide with Nate Goyer.
Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
Well, hello, hello, hello. Hi, everyone. Thanks for tuning into The Vinyl Guide. Happy New Year. Happy 2020. I hope you're all doing well. We're back from our break. Man, I do want to thank everyone for their emails, their messages, their concern. For me and the family regarding the recent Australian bushfires. They're still going on, unfortunately. We haven't had a blue sky at all this entire summer. It's always been gray and hazy, sometimes brown. And that's due to the Australian bushfires, which no doubt you guys have probably seen on the news. Thankfully, my family and I and all our friends are safe, but many people have been sadly affected by the tragedy. I talked about it at the top of the show. We're donating all the money from patreon.com/vinylguide to the victims. And by the way, there's a really cool John 5 interview up there we released as a holiday gift for the Patreon community. So go there now, listen to us talk to John 5, and do something good. patreon.com/vinylguide. You'll get some cool content and you'll help those who have been affected by the Australian bushfires. This week is very, very special. We have an incredible guest. Dr. Demento is our guest for the first episode of the year 2020. And today, Dr. D discusses many things. Now, you may know Dr. Demento as a radio legend who brought funny music to the masses. I used to listen to him every Sunday night as a child, and man, did he shape my brain. However, what you may not know is Dr. Demento is a record collector with an amazing collection, which he'll discuss today. I mean, so many records are part of his collection. In fact, they once collapsed a room in his home. So he'll go through and tell a bit of that story today, plus heaps more. And Dr. Demento, he's still doing a weekly show. Head over to drdemento.com. Check out his radio show. He's got a humongous archive. Plus, he's also released this new LP called Covered in Punk, which we'll discuss further with him today. Now, before we get too much further, I do want to tell you about a great website for record collectors that I discovered recently, audiophileusa.com. Now, at this site, I am finding original vinyl pressings of some amazing records in near mint shape at very reasonable prices. No more dodgy eBay traders who tell you the record is near mint only to have it shipped to you and find out it was VG at best. AudiophileUSA.com ships worldwide and again only features records that are in extremely high quality condition. Many of these are original pressings still sealed in shrink wrap. I have no idea how they do it, but the AudiophileUSA.com guys seem to find extremely high quality original pressings in the wild and make them available to you. So take it from me, AudiophileUSA.com is quality. Go to AudiophileUSA.com and find your holy grail. Alrighty, well, that's it for the upfronts. Let's get into the first Vinyl Guide interview of the new decade. It's radio and record collecting legend, Dr. Demento.
Fish heads, roly-poly fish heads, eat them up, yum. Fish heads, full-sides, roly-poly full-sides, fish heads, full-sides, eat them up, yum. In the morning, laughing happy fish heads, in the evening, floating in the soup. Fish heads, roly-poly fish heads, eat them up, yum.
All right, this week on the Vinyl Guide, we are beneath the smogberry trees with none other than radio and record legend, Dr. Demento. Good day to you, Dr. D. How are you feeling today?
Woo-woo! Wind up your radio! Hello, Vinyl Guide! Hello, Australia! Hello, world!
Just to let everyone know, the good doctor continues to work on his weekly radio show, available streaming at drdemento.com. There is a subscription available there to enjoy all the archives of decades and decades of Dr. Demento. Dr. Demento is also celebrating the number one comedy album, Covered in Punk, which is a compilation of songs made popular on his radio show. The stuff like Fish Heads, Dead Puppies, I Love Beans, Shaving Cream, Lydia the Tattooed Lady, one of my personal favorites, covered in a punk attitude by artists such as The Misfits, The Meatmen, The Dead Milkmen, Osaka Pop Star, Joan Jett, William Shatner, and more. Covered in Punk is available now at coveredinpunk.com. It just occurred to me that the music that you had certainly inspired me as a child. I remember having the cassette tapes on the schoolyard and listening to things like Another One Rides the Bus over and over and over again, but it must have also inspired a whole generation of misfits, which I think went on to be in large numbers in the punk community.
Yes, yeah. Some of them made their way into punk. Some of them went in other directions, but yeah, they certainly have something in common. And in fact, I recognized that even when punk was first getting off the ground. There I was in Los Angeles, and I read a story in the newspaper about the Sex Pistols and how they were creating all this fuss over in England. And people were saying they ought to be banned and run out of the country and all that stuff. So I happened to know there was one place I could get the Sex Pistols' new single in Los Angeles. And I went and got me one and played it on my show. It was definitely not what people were used to hearing on my show, but I put it out there as something that was new and noteworthy and had some connection with some of the music that I played. And so people responded to that, perhaps even a little more when the Ramones came along. And they had songs like Beat on the Brat, which is done by Weird Al Yankovic on the new album, and the Blitzkrieg Bop and other such fun things.
That's interesting. You'd read an article about a controversial group or song, and where a lot of people would run away from it, you would run towards it. You would embrace it if you could.
Exactly. I mean, a few years earlier, of course, we got newspaper stories about the Beatles long before we ever heard their music in this country.
What's the best general description for the music that you're most known for? I tend to refer to it as novelty music, but is there a better term?
I just call it funny music. Novelty music is what a lot of it was regarded as at the time, but the music industry tends to define that rather narrowly. And for me, it's anything that's funny or unusual or different or bizarre or that I just like and think my audience might like. It's as simple as that. Very, very subjective.
Okay. Can you take us through a history of that genre of music? Just a brief history, an overview, so we have that perspective.
Of funny music? Okay. Well, it's been around since as long as the phonograph has been around. People started recording funny songs, and especially stand-up routines, because they were really easy to do, in the early days of the phonograph. And so as time passed and different styles came down the pike, there were funny songs in these different styles. And so there were in the 1920s, we had a bunch of what you could call novelty songs, certainly, like Yes, We Have No Bananas. That was the biggest one. Barney Google was real big. And they were funny songs that people enjoyed hearing, singing along with in the 1920s. In the late 20s and early 30s, radio was the thing, and so most of what was happening in comedy was happening on live radio, but then records started to come back in a big way. And of the 1940s, certainly the biggest star in funny music was Spike Jones, who was also popular all over the English-speaking world. But he had a bunch of hit records. He had a network radio show. He had TV shows. He was a big star. And that lasted about 10 years. Then you have, in the 50s, Stan Freberg had a bunch of hits. The late Stan Freberg was absolutely great at gentle yet principled and forthright satire on all the things that he thought were worth making fun of, both in song and in sketch. So, and then we have the core of the novelty record era, when it was not so much one singer standing out above the crowd, but a whole bunch of them having often just one hit at a time and then fading away where they came from. So some of the earlier ones of that type were 1956, The Flying Saucer, Buchanan and Goodman, which is the one where it acts like a news reporter on scene for TV news or something like that, and he asks people lots of questions, and they answer with lines from songs taken from the actual hit record. Those were some of the first records to use sampling, so which was very controversial at the time. And then you had the Purple People Eater. That was something that everybody loved, and it was an instant several million selling records. And David Seville with the Witch Doctor, and then all the Chipmunks records, they were definitely related to that. 1962, you get Bobby Morris Pickett and the Monster Mash, which was absolutely huge. And then kind of the moment passed for that sort of thing. Rock began taking itself more seriously. The Beatles, for better or worse, were leaders in that, because instead of doing I Want to Hold Your Hand, they were doing albums that were to be taken seriously, like Abbey Road. That was a work of art. And I love it, don't get me wrong, but it was a whole different way of listening to music than had been true with the Purple People Eater. So people began taking music more seriously, and the top 40, the big pop music stations, pretty much stopped playing funny music. And that was the time when the Dr. Demento show got started, because there was a vacuum. Nature abhors a vacuum. And there I was to step in and fill the vacuum by bringing back the old hits. And when I'd find a new one that seemed worth playing, I'd stick that one in too.
It sounds like from the very beginning, of course, records were translated from vaudeville. You get these vaudeville actors, actresses that would put their act onto a record, and it would distributed around the country. And then what's interesting, we recently had on our show a guy named John Tefteller who collects blues records.
Oh, yes. He's the record collector.
He is the guy. And we were talking a little bit about some of the content of some of those blues records, which were there's sexual innuendos, there was violence. It was quite striking once you kind of understood what it was about. And it sounds to me like that could have a bit of a genesis. That's an interesting place to look for some of the early funny music.
Yeah, there were some funny blues. No, it wasn't really known best for humor, but but, you know, my career took a left turn. Back before I was Dr. Demento and all that, I was best known as a blues expert in the 60s. I wrote articles about blues and sometimes other kinds of early rock music, but a lot about blues. That was my thing.
Yeah, and a lot of these underground blues records, they were sold under the counter. They were shunned by the general public. Am I correct in kind of assuming that a lot of these novelty records, these funny records of that time, are in such low numbers?
Well, you know, the funny records from the 20s and 30s, you're not really dealing with that, because that was vaudeville, that was popular. Mm-hmm. Like I say, blues was there, and it was great. It was magnificent. And now and then there'd be something humorous. But that's not what it was known for. The ones that were humorous, the humor mainly came from them being salacious, shall we say. Mm-hmm. You know, from the dealing with sex, which Al Jolson and people like that didn't sing about sex in the same kind of frank metaphors that Bessie Smith might have.
Humor is such a major part of so many entertainment forms, movies, yes. Television, but it seems to be relegated to somewhat of a minor role in music. Why do you feel that is?
Well, good question. I suppose because humor is presented in other mediums, tends to be quite visual, and records are by definition not very visual. Though, of course, with the development of the music video, something kind of akin to a record now has all the video on it, and you can see the jokes too, as well as hear them. So,
going back a ways, your entry into being interested in music, what was it that really kind of lit that fire? Do you recall the records and the music that really started you on the path to becoming Dr. Demento?
No, I suppose it happened when I was 4 years old and my dad brought home a brand new record, just come out, Cocktails for Two by Spike Jonze, which was his first million seller and one of his all-time biggest hits, making fun of an old song, which for the first half minute of the record, it's done perfectly straight with harps and sweet singing, and then gunshots go off and they devastate that song for the rest of the record. And Spike Jonze made many other hits after that, some of which were certainly released in Australia and England and everywhere English was spoken.
Okay, so your father brings home this record, he puts it on the turntable, and I imagine as a four-year-old, you watched your father react to this record, and that was pretty impressive for a kid.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I had already learned to run the phonograph. That was something remarkable about me as a kid. 4 years old, they let me operate the phonograph and handle their breakable 78 RPM records. And I was as good at it as they were. I had an accident once in a great while, but no more than they did. So they were happy to let me do that and educate myself about music. Their taste ran to classical music and show tunes, but they realized that Spike Jonze was happening and, that their young son would probably get a kick out of it, and I certainly did. So
you were a DJ from the very early days.
Yeah, he brought home several more Spike Jonze records and other hits. The Too Fat Polka was very big in the 40s by Arthur Godfrey, and a couple other versions of it, too. Civilization, bongo, 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 I don't want to leave the jungle, you know, which is considered a little politically incorrect now, but it was a huge hit in 1947.
Wow. You seem to be a guy who remembers a lot of details, who played on a record, the connections between them, even the origin of the artist or what became of them. Is that something that just your brain just absorbs that sort of information?
Yeah, gradually. That information was not easy to find in the 40s and even the 50s, even the 60s, you started getting a few more detailed discographies and books about these older artists. But when I very first started, I had to learn all that stuff on my own, just gleaning. I had a Billboard magazine, which was the main weekly periodical of the music industry at that time in this country. It's still going. I used to read the new issue at the library every week on the way home from school. So I learned what was going on. I also learned there was such a thing as rhythm and blues music. My high school was 99% white, so I didn't get exposed to that a lot growing up. But I realized that I could find that music on stations that beamed up from the southern U.S., from Arkansas and Louisiana, that I could get late at night up in Minnesota where I was living. So I taught myself about that music at the same time as my pretty much exact contemporary, Bob Dylan, was listening to those same stations up in far northern Minnesota and getting thunderstruck by it like I was.
And at this point, are you starting to amass your record collection? Were you living and any money you went started going towards records?
Pretty much. I learned to go without lunch for a while to get more records. I would make, my allowance was $1.50 a week. You know, this was the 50s. It was a while ago. So, but I got another dollar and a half a week for lunch. So I would just go without lunch or just have a candy bar or something and spend that money on records. I wanted, okay, in 1952, I discovered there was a store. I took the bus and the trolley car across town to go to school because my folks wanted me to be in a special school, which was great. I loved it as much as I could like any school at that age. So the bus would pass a store in a not terribly nice neighborhood with a sign that said, used records like new, 19 cents. Mm. So I went in there and I found that what they had was records that had just been taken off jukeboxes. So they were the hits from maybe 3 or 6 months ago. So, which was new enough for me. If I liked the song, I still liked it. So sure, I'll pay 19 cents for the record, try and find a copy that's not too worn out. I learned to do that pretty quickly. Jukeboxes would do that.
So with $3 a week in your pocket, you would that could generate as many as 15 records for you, plus a soda here and there.
Except just a few months after I discovered the jukebox place, I found the Salvation Army store. At first I thought, well, that's just where old men go to, you know, have a place to live if they're poor and something. But then I realized that they also sold all kinds of used merchandise, including books and records. So in one of their stores, they had records for a nickel apiece, 5 cents, you know, which, so that meant I could buy 20 of them for a dollar. And there were just piles and piles of them, piled maybe two or three feet high and probably 30 piles like that, all 78s. Mostly 10-inch, but they had a few piles of 12-inch, too.
Now, at this time, I imagine you're bringing home these stacks of records, and your parents are starting to wonder what's happening here. How did they react to your interests?
Actually, my mom was kind of delighted because I had already read a book, which my folks gave me for Christmas, about the history of popular music in America, a book that came out in 1947. I still have it. And that pretty much told the history of the Tin Pan Alley era. So I knew the highlights of that. So I'd see songs of the Salvation Army that had been mentioned in that book. And then I soon found out that my mother remembered many of those songs from when she was a kid. I bring home a record by Jean Austen, who was her favorite singer when she was a kid, when she was a teenager, until she discovered Bing Crosby, who was new and much sexier than Jean Austen. So she became a big fan of his.
And at this point in time, is funny music, is novelty music even on your radar, or are you still just collecting different types of music and just seeing what it is you like?
Well, novelty music was on my radar. We were getting into the big novelty record era. So I heard the music that was on the radio, and I kept up with the music that was on the top 40, and I developed a taste for rockabilly and for R&B. I found some of the R&B records at that jukebox place. They had jukeboxes in black neighborhoods, so was able to get copies of some of the things I had read about in Billboard, and got to quickly realize which artists I really liked and would look for more records. I'd look for Atlantic Records or Specialty Records, or after a little while, Sun Records. And I certainly got to know, and Chess Records, of course. So got to know all those. We heard Heartbreak Hotel, and all the kids in my school were kind of lukewarm to pop music before that. The girls liked it, but they tended to like Eddie Fisher and that kind of thing. For the boys, when I first started school, 1953-54, pop music wasn't considered quite the right thing for boys to really like. Boys were supposed to like war movies, guns, and stuff like that. But when Elvis came along, Bill Haley to a lesser extent, but especially Elvis, that made it legit and quite passable and even, you know, fun for boys to like rock and roll music. So I fit in right in with that, along with, I was pursuing several different threads at once. The old stuff, the R&B, and what was on the charts right then.
All your attention is really focused on music. So there didn't seem to be a doubt in your mind that your career, your future, was going to be around records and music. Was that the plan?
My folks certainly steered. They would have loved to have me become a university professor because I got real good grades in school, so that seemed to be a fitting destination for me.
Well, you are a doctor now. I mean, they should be very proud.
Yeah, well, a doctor of dementia. I have a master's degree. That is recognized by academia. Master's degree in folk music studies from UCLA.
Mm.
Fairly big deal.
Oh, yeah. What was your thesis on?
My thesis was on the early development of rhythm and blues. So what I did, I wanted to write about the history of rhythm and blues. But they said, no, this is a master's thesis, not an encyclopedia. Pick a very narrow topic and write about that. Mm-hmm. So what I did was I went down to the local office of Billboard magazine. They thought I was serious and let me in, and I was serious. And they let me go through their stacks, and I wrote down the songs that had been most popular through the years. I copied down their old charts and made notation. I had to do it all. They let me use a typewriter, but I had to do it by hand, no computers. This was the 60s. So, but I put together these charts of the top R&B songs, according to Billboard, from 1945 to 53. And subjected all, let's see, so that was 8 years, I guess, and the top 10 records for each year, so that was 80 records. Mm-hmm. And I got copies of those and subjected them all to musicological analysis to show that I'd learned that stuff, and drew certain conclusions as I went along about how the music had evolved between 1945 and 53. And so they looked at that covered a lot of Louis Jordan hits, covered the biggest hit the first year that I covered was The Honey Dripper by Joe Liggins, which was just huge.
That must have been great preparation for your role at Specialty Records, which was an R&B.
Oh, absolutely. It led directly to that role because the owner of Specialty Records, still with us, bless him, he's 101, Art Roop, he was a UCLA business school graduate and very involved in alumni affairs of UCLA's business school. So he learned through the grapevine that somebody had written a thesis, not for the business school, but for the folklore and mythology department. I'd written a thesis on rhythm and blues music, and that interested Art Roop, who was just getting ready to go into the music business at that time. And he realized at that point, I'm talking back in 1945 before I came along, he realized that R&B, or race music as they still called it in 45, was a open opportunity for a young entrepreneur starting a new record company. So when he discovered in 1967 that I had written this thesis, it perked him up and he got the thesis out of the library and read it, got my phone number, and one day out of the blue, I was sitting at home and the phone rang and it was Art Roop. And I knew who he was, so when he invited me to lunch, I said, well, sure, I'd be happy to. That led, after a couple of meetings, that led to a job, and I worked there for 3 years at Specialty Records.
What did you do at Specialty?
My title was Director of Product Development. Anyway, my job was to go through all their archives. I listened to every note that they'd recorded through their history over the course of the 3 years and picked out what might be good to reissue that hadn't been reissued yet. They actually haven't done very many reissues before I got there, but they I put together 27 albums for them during the time that I worked there. No, 35 albums in R&B, gospel music, some hardcore blues, John Lee Hooker primarily, Frankie Lee Sims, Guitar Slim. Hmm. I assembled those albums for LPs, and so a lot of those albums are still available. Billy Vera worked for them at a later date and expanded many of them for CD.
This is kind of the mid-60s, around the time when a lot of college students in the U.S. were getting into the blues, discovering the blues. Do I have that timeline? That's right.
Yeah, and that was, we realized that there was that audience happening for blues.
Okay, so you were the perfect person in there. Just graduating college, you were right, you know, a clear understanding of the blues.
I guess I was, yeah.
And then how did Warner Brothers lure you away? Apparently you went there and started producing their Lost Leaders series.
Yeah, okay. Well, a brief history of what happened. I worked for Specialty for 3 years, put a lot of good reissues together, but they also invited me to take a flyer at doing some new recordings, and which I did. Fairly contemporary recordings. We signed a rock band, a teenage rock band. They were just teenagers, but they played fairly ambitious music. It was not supposed to be like the Monkees or anything like that. Their idol was Cream and Jack Bruce and Eric Clapton. They certainly didn't have the command of the music that those guys did, but they made music that was popular with their contemporaries and locally at least a little bit popular. I mean, we especially did not have the resources or the capability to promote that album in the way that the major labels did. But still, it's out there, an album by a group called Kingdom, and it's even available on CD now. You know, they'll reissue any darn thing these days. So anyway, I put this out and had a little bit of local success and really enjoyed having that under my belt. But after that, did not sell very well. I just gradually parted ways. I kind of maybe wanted to do something that was more involved with contemporary music. You know, there's very exciting times for contemporary music in the late 60s, especially in Los Angeles. So I wanted to be part of that. I had seen my folk and blues friends turn into rock stars. Most prominently, that would be Canned Heat. They were real close friends of mine. I even was a roadie for them for a little while. And they had one album that sold very well and a few others that got up on the charts. So they had some success. They had tragedy too. The most talented guy died at 27, Alan Wilson. So I saw that before that tragedy, I saw them ascend to rock stardom and kind of wanted to be more a part of that world. And one way that I could kind of get into it would be in radio, because those were the days of underground radio. We were lucky enough to have in Los Angeles a station called KPPC, which was originally started by the Pasadena Presbyterian Church. That's the PPC. But they had sold the station, and it had fallen into the hands of resourceful and talented hippies, shall we say. And so I fell in with that crowd pretty quickly. And we kicked around one thing and another and figured out one thing I could do for them, even while I was still working at Specialty. I could do a weekly program of rare rock and roll oldies. I started doing it as a regular guest shot in 1970, October 1970, and then was hired by the station for a regular shift of my own in March 71, and onward and upward I went. And they gave me the name Dr. Demento. They said, you can't be Barry Hanson, you need a funny name. So all the other jocks had funny names, so I became Dr. Demento. It was a name that they gave me. And
and so that was 1971. You started becoming a full-time disc jockey.
Well, not full-time. It was just once a week.
Oh, okay. Once a week. But you started gaining...
Meanwhile, I stayed in the record business for a while. This is just a detour, but for 3 months, I was a full-time radio disc jockey, not in L.A., but in San Francisco. I was swept in with one change of management and out with the next. But anyway, I had that little experience under my belt, which gave me more comfort and ease on the air. It did that for me.
Oh, okay. So it's interesting. I guess you've been, I guess, a part-time disc jockey for many decades then, if you've done...
Oh, yes. Yeah. Okay. And you know, for the last 30 years or so, being Dr. Demento in one way or another has been my full-time gig.
What do you credit for it growing in popularity? Between 71, when you started on a regular shift, and then 74, when it was syndicated... What would you credit to the growth of the interest?
It became something that kids would listen to on Sunday night. I mean, junior high, high school, into college, mostly at that time. And they tell their friends about it. I heard this crazy song, this shaving cream. I heard this song about people smoking dope and all this stuff that people would whisper to each other about. And then there's fish heads and dead puppies, a crazy song, and this guy just plays that stuff all the time. And I sounded, I think, half professional and half amateur, so I kind of sounded a little bit like one of them. I certainly never had the big professional sound, never had the big deep voice, and didn't really have the patter down like the top 40 jocks did, that they could wind them up and they could spout these praises on automatic pilot for on and on and on. I was never quite like that. So it was always more like one-to-one.
Yeah. When I was young and I'd listen to your show, it was very relatable. You were very authentic, and it wasn't like someone putting on an act. It was someone you could tell really enjoyed the music, which I think is a huge draw. So at that time, that was a time when a DJ could have a unique personality. When did the hat and tuxedo come in the picture?
I'd been doing it for a couple of years at that point, just once a week, but I got a manager who felt that there was more to the personality than had been exploited up to that time. And I went to the Grammy Awards, and I had to rent a tux for that. So my new manager said, you look great in that. You ought to wear that every time you make a public appearance. So I got myself a tux and a top hat, and there I was. And that hasn't changed much since then.
It's an amalgamation of several of the Marx Brothers.
Yes, right.
Now, when the show was syndicated in 1974, and you would press records of each of those shows and distribute them, that's how the show was essentially franchised, yeah?
Well, yeah, they did. They used discs at different times. They used them for, you go to the Demented Music Database, DMDB online, dmdb.org, which my archivist, Jeff Morris, runs for me. And
thanks, Jeff.
dmdb.org, sure. And so on there you will find the whole history of how physically the show was distributed. In a nutshell, it was on tape first, and then it was on disc, and then it was on tape again, and then it was on disc again, and then finally to CD.
Now, when it came to the criteria of which songs got played, are you the only decision maker in what's played and what isn't?
Yes. Yeah, sure. I mean, once in a while, I get a word from the station, we'd rather you didn't play that one. And of course, I learned quickly what I could get away with as far as the Federal Communications Commission goes, the governmental agency that controls the radio industry and TV and many other things here.
Would you feel they were pretty lenient with you, or do you feel you were targeted in any way?
I don't think I was targeted. I guess somebody there must have felt that I was a fairly benign presence. I didn't, unlike somebody like Frank Zappa, more power to him, or Howard Stern, whatever you might think of him, unlike them, I didn't really feel it my mission to challenge the FCC. I was willing to live with what, you know, with the rules as they had been laid down and followed by radio for years before I got there, but tweak them a little bit, maybe. Mm-hmm. So somebody must have figured that the show was kind of, you know, not something that would, something that would, was as likely to amuse people from the old order as to try and overturn it. So, you know, if political conservatives enjoy my show, more power to them.
I seem to recall you were okay with beeping things. I remember having a cassette tape of you played George Carlin's Seven Dirty Words, and it was so full of beeps, and I was trying to figure out what was behind those beeps. But that sounds to be like a regular occurrence on the Dr. Demento show. And if there was something was too salacious, you just beep it.
Yeah. You know, record companies would make their own beep versions, and I'd sometimes make my own too. And actually, a friend of mine made the version of George Carlin's Seven Words, but I did a good one of Titties and Beer by Frank Zappa, so that was much acclaimed in its day.
Are there songs you used to be able to play but steer away from now? And the one I'm thinking of is Kinko the Clown is one I'm thinking of now. But you know, what are some?
I still play that. You know, not often, maybe once a year. I still play that. I mean, the clown gets hustled off to jail at the end, so it's not really endorsing it. I mean, they're kind of laughing over this character. You know, that's a borderline case. What I thought maybe you were going to ask me about is some of the things from earlier times that espoused attitude towards women, and in the very earlier times, attitudes towards people of different races that are not considered kosher today, not considered something you'd play on a radio station.
And those are ones that you've had to evolve out of the playlist, yeah?
Yeah, well, you know, one song that became controversial fairly recently, something that was considered perfectly G-rated in its day, a famous Australian song, Tie Me Kangaroo Down Sport, originally by Rolf Harris. That was a hit over here when it came out in the early 60s, and Let Me Abbos Go Loose. Nobody knew what an abbo was over here, so people assumed it was some other kind of funny Australian animal, I think. Pardon me, I didn't mean to cast a slur there, but that's what I thought when I first heard it. But anyway, and then, of course, Rolf Harris is kind of on the outskis for a totally different reason now. But
there's many reasons to pull that one out.
Yeah, that would be an example of something that was okay in the days of yore, not so much now. There are other songs where we've gone the other way. You know, when I started, there were certain words you could not say on TV or on the radio, and one of those words, at least at the stations I was at, we weren't supposed to use the word fart. And on morning shows today, you might hear that a dozen times in one show. I've kind of rolled with the punches on that one.
So there are songs that that you used to be able to play that you beeped, and now no beeping required.
Right. Well, especially now that I'm streaming online, I'm no FCC. I'm not involved with that at all. And I'm not involved with any station management that has to keep their sponsors happy. And I've had more trouble with censorship because of station management and their sponsors than I ever have because of the FCC.
And I was also very pleased to see at drdemento.com, you also mention when some of the curse words could come up. Like, for instance, if someone wants to play the songs or the weekly show for their children, you say, well, there's the F word, the third song in. You give people a heads up.
Yeah, I do that. Sometimes I forget, but I usually do that. We've got an interesting case right now, song that's been very big just in the past year. It's actually 2 years old, but it came from England, and it's a song called, I'll leave it here, I've Got No More to Give. No more, it's the F word in there, and it uses, the lyrics of this song use the F word probably 20 times in the course of the song. And it's interesting that after you've heard it 10 times, and always in a non-sexual context, it becomes just something funny. You know, it loses all the offensiveness that word so often has, even today. And so that's, my new show, The Countdown, is now out there, so I can now say here that it wound up being the number 2 song of the year.
Do you have a top 5 funny 5 for your career?
For my career, yeah. Let's see, it would be Fish Heads is number 1 by a nose over Dead Puppies, and coming in number 3, a song that was well known outside of my show, They're Coming to Take Me Away, Ha Ha, by Napoleon the 14th. Mm-hmm. After that, it gets a little, let me see if I can look on the computer. The last time we attempted to compile an all-time list, it was earlier this year, and I'm having a little trouble calling to my mind exactly what we decided.
Shaving Cream would have to be in there, wouldn't it?
Shaving Cream's up there, yes. It's in the top 10. And, of course, I recorded my own version of that. I've done it twice, as a matter of fact. plus, occasionally sing new verses on the air.
Tell me a little bit about your connections with Frank Zappa. You mentioned him a few times today. He was always creating music that seemed to fit and align pretty well with the show format. What was your connection? What was your relationship with Frank?
Well, it all started when I was still working for my master's degree, and one of my fellow master's candidates had gone to the Whiskey A Go Go here in the Los Angeles area and heard Frank Zappa of the Mothers play very early in their career before they had any record, before they had any albums out. So they had a few singles, but that was all. So she said I should go and hear them, which I did. And then she said she'd introduce me to Frank, which she did. And I got invited to his house. Not the utility muffin research kitchen, but an earlier place that he had. It was just an apartment, but a pretty nice apartment, and he had some of his records there. And Frank invited me to his apartment, and we listened to a few records and got to talking about music. He was very intrigued that I was somebody who knew something about, could carry on a conversation about, on the one hand, the R&B music from the early 50s, which he dearly loved, including what they used to call street corner or doo-wop vocal quartets of the early to mid-50s. And on the other hand, I could also carry on a conversation about avant-garde classical music, about Bartok and Stravinsky and the 12-tone school and Frank's personal favorite, Edgard Varèse.
So you two seem to be kind of cut from the same cloth there.
Kind of. I mean, very, very different backgrounds. I mean, he was a street kid. I was raised among academic people. Mm-hmm. So very, very different in that way. We were about the same age. He was a year and a half older than me.
But in terms of interests and tastes, there seems to be a strong...
And right.
your careers both seem to grow at the same time, in parallel, and supportive of one another.
Yeah, well, I realized that he was making contemporary music that I loved myself, and when I got the Dr. Demento show, I could play it as part of the show. At first, I didn't play it a lot because at KPPC, they played Zappa all day long.
And you both produced Wild Man Fisher.
Yeah, well, Frank produced him. I was good friends with the people who produced his later albums, but I did not produce one myself. I don't want to estate claim for something like that. But I was, Barnes and Barnes, the guys who did Fish Heads, they did his two later albums, the Rhino albums.
So venturing into record collecting here, you have a notoriously tremendous record collection. Do you know of a number? What is the number of records or approximate number of records that you you have in your house?
Not really. It's in the six figures. I lost count a long time ago. And I've had to move a couple of times in my life and had to slim down each time. I realized I'll never play this again. So.
And in terms of your records, how are they stored? Like, how do you have a database that you keep track of them in, or do you just know where they're
all at? Not everything. The things I play on the show, they're in a database. I'm looking at it right now. It's the Demented Music Database, which Jeff Morris maintains, but the data all comes from me.
Okay.
So that lists all the songs I've ever played, and I have other databases. When I started transferring music from records or tapes to CDRs, I realized I had to have a way of keeping track of them. Before I knew it, I had hundreds of CDRs, each one miscellaneous artists. And often there were just things that I needed to transfer at the same time for the next week's show, rather than things that really had anything to do with each other. So I had to keep track of those, and I had a computer by that time, so I do have a database of those. As for the records, no, it's pretty much in my head, and I keep them as much as I can manage in alphabetical order on the shelves.
Do you still buy records? Do you still add to the collection?
Some, not like I used to, partly because I'm getting as much music as I can use on the show, and I'm either using the stuff I've had for a while, or it comes on MP3s or in the mail. I still get CDs in the mail, but a lot of it comes now online, both old and new records. I mean, I thought people used to say, oh, you must have every record that's ever been made. And, I'm maybe up to 0.5% when you consider all the records that have been made in the world. I mean, never mind what we can understand. How about Chinese records? They've made millions of them over there. So.
That's right. Now, at the peak record madness, were records in every room of the house?
Yes. Yeah, sure. In this house, there is some form of recorded music in every room, more in some rooms than others. Oh, there's not much in the bathroom anymore. I used to store a bunch of them in the bathroom. One of the bathtubs never got used, so I filled that with records. When I lived in a one room apartment back in the 60s, that was full of records. I'd take my showers at UCLA.
At what point does the hobby become inconvenient?
Oh, I won't. I mean, if I were going to move again, that would be a major expedition. And, I've been around a while, so the time is going to come. I can't quite imagine, unless I somehow come into a whole lot of money, it's hard for me to imagine that at age 92, I will really be able to manage this record collection. Like, I cannot lift a box of 178s anymore.
Right.
I can't do it. I used to be able to.
I mean, structurally, the houses must be under a tremendous amount of pressure with that many records.
Well, that's why most of them in this place are in what used to be the garage, which has a slab floor. Mm-hmm. It's not like the house, you've heard the story about the house I was in before this one, where the floor started to collapse. That was just a conventional suburban house, like this house is, but I don't keep the majority of the records in the house. They're in the other building.
So at some point, you're going to have to reduce your records quite substantially. Do you know which records you want to keep for yourself for the rest of your days?
Not right now. It's something I will have to make choices, probably bit by bit as I go along.
Well, what are some of your most special records? The records that you look at, and maybe they're not the most valuable or whatever, but the most special to you. Do you have a handful of them?
It would be, you know, what's special to me, what I might keep after everything else is gone, is the things that I loved in my childhood, my teenage years, and maybe into the early years of being Dr. Demento. Not necessarily the ones that are most valuable, though I know enough so that if something goes out the door, I should get a good price for it.
Do you have any exceedingly rare records?
There's a few blues that certainly get up there, Charlie Patton and people like that.
Oh, okay.
Robert Johnson, there's a couple of those.
And I imagine those were some of the records that you found at the swap meet or something like that?
In a couple of cases, yes. But, you know, other cases, I traded them with other collectors. I bought them at auction a time or two. You know, some of the big mail auctions.
What's the most you've ever paid for a record?
I don't think I ever paid $1,000. Probably 500. Mm-hmm. One of the Charlie Pattons was 500.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a good investment because most Charlie Pattons are well north of that.
Yes, they are. So, I mean, that was 30 or, tell you where I got that one. It was after Bob Height passed away. Some of his records were offered for sale, and I bought a handful of them.
Got it. And you're still making records covered in punk? I've very much been enjoying this album. And you've got William Shatner doing a cover of The Cramps' Garbage Man. Institutionalized being done by Brack. Joan Jett, Misfits, Meat Men. In terms of the contribution of the album, which track took you most by surprise?
Well, you know, the one that's really been the sleeper hit is the one by Brack, Institutionalized. That's been the most popular, most requested one on my show.
It's a great album. Again, I want to remind people to go to coveredinpunk.com. There is vinyl available, which is great. You could also stream it and check it out initially on Apple Music. I think it's on Spotify. There's quite a few really interesting tracks on here. Finally, Dr. Demento, what do you want your legacy to be?
Oh, that I got some people interested in some kinds of music that they might not otherwise have discovered, whether it be Weird Al or Frank Zappa. And certainly in terms of popular culture, I may be best remembered as the guy who discovered and launched the career of Weird Al Yankovic. And he's great. I have no qualms about that. But beyond that, I would want people to remember me as somebody who kept them entertained, freed them from whatever bad situations they had at home or at school or whatever. I've had so many people say, I survived high school only because of you, or I survived my parents only because of you, doctor. So, and that certainly is a thrill to hear that, to realize that I really made a difference in somebody's life. And just got people interested in forms of entertainment that might otherwise have just fallen away into the mists of time, and maybe some that should still be there, but I brought them back for better or for worse. And with shaving cream, whatever one might think of the merits of that song, I did a good deed by making that record popular and reviving Benny Bell's career.
Yeah, you just discovered that record almost randomly, as I understand.
Credit where credit's due. Another collector, a fellow named Brad Kay, here in Los Angeles, found that record somewhere and played it for me. And he said, you ought to like this one. He played it, and I said, well, yeah, that'd be great for my show. Can I make a tape of it? Yes. So I brought the tape home, and then as luck would have it, not more than a month later, I found a nice, clean copy of myself in a Salvation Army store.
All right. Well, Dr. Demento, thank you so much for coming on The Vinyl Guide. I can tell you personally, your show has been such a bit of a life raft to young me, listening to it every Sunday night and taping those songs and really just letting the humor seep in. And it really made music something that wasn't so serious. It could be fun. And I imagine there are tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of other people out there that have that same experience. And our childhoods wouldn't have been the same. Our adulthoods wouldn't be the same if it weren't for Dr. Demento. And that legacy continues. People can go to drdemento.com. Every week, it's another two-hour show. Dr. Demento talking records, sharing some of those funny songs. And this is all commercial-free, and a lot of great information is up there at drdemento.com, plus years and years archive of all past shows. If you want to go back to the to listen to a show from a certain week in the 70s, you can do that at drdemento.com, and I encourage you to do so. Also, make sure to check out Covered in Punk. This is a Dr. Demento produced set collection of songs, some of the famous Dr. Demento tracks redone by punk legends of the day. You could hear that and order it at coveredinpunk.com. Yes, vinyl is available, and check it out. It is a really fun listen. Dr. D, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been an absolute honor.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure for me. Got to give props to John Caffiero. He produced the Covered in Punk album, but the music all came from me.
That's right. Thank you, John, and thank you, Dr. Demento.
Don't forget to stay demented.
There he is, radio and record legend, Dr. Demento. I do want to thank Mike Vague and John Caffiero for connecting me with the good doctor and helping me realize my dream of talking to a legend and a hero of mine since my youth. And again, go to drdemento.com, check out the Doc's weekly radio show, and coveredinpunk.com. Check out this album. It really is a fun listen. And that's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Episode 198 all wrapped up. Who's episode 200? Who's episode 199? Who's episode 201? Well, you're going to have to stick around and find out. Subscribe on Apple iTunes. The Vinyl Guide is now on Spotify. You can get us there. Of course, we have Android apps, and we're available wherever you listen to podcasts. Share them on social media. Tell your friends. And again, patreon.com/vinylguide. Get exclusive content while helping the victims of the Australian bushfires. And wow, that's a lot to say. I'm going to let you guys go. Until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate at thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram at Vinyl Guide. Until next time, keep spinning.